The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast. See, Derek Varn is the guest this week. Varn is a reader at Zero Books, a poet, and a teacher currently living in Cairo. He was once my co-host on the now-defunct Pop the Left podcast, and in this episode of Zero Squared, we discuss last year's online debate between Sam Harris and Noam Chomsky, as well as our tendency on the left to avoid difficult arguments. The Mott and Bailey Doctrine is mentioned, and utilitarian and deontological or Kantian ethics are discussed. It's Wednesday, October 12th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to let you know that this is the first half of the conversation. If you want to hear the rest, you can sign up to become a member of the Zero Books Club and get access to our membership site. I should also let you know that coming soon in October, we will have our first Zero Books workshop online, and I will invite all of our members to participate and make the video of that, or the audio of that probably, available to members. We're going to be discussing Michael Hart and Antonio Negri's Empire. So if you have that book and you're a member, you might read the first chapter. I'm going to be sending an email to you soon. That's going to be with Andy Marshall. And then in months ahead, we'll have Zero Books authors give workshops on their books, and as well as having Andy Marshall come back to discuss Hart and Negri's Empire. Thanks to all the members who are already signed up. If you'd like to participate, get the membership podcast, sign up for our workshop, and help Zero Books, go to our website, our Zero Books blog, and sign up. In this episode, you'll hear clips from the online course Law and Justice, the song Telstar by the Tornadoes, a clip from the Waking Up podcast with Sam Harris, and a short clip from the film Fight Club. Right now, you're listening to new.wave. Hallucinations. But in just a moment, you'll hear C. Derek Varn and I discuss Sam Harris and Noam Chomsky. We've become a content mill now with these two podcasts a week. I'm always desperate for material, which is another way that it's very difficult to be coherent.
I mean, like, you and I are talking about Sam Harris. That's how desperate we are for content.
But I think Sam Harris is important.
I think the problem that you represent, that he represents there, and how bad that was played is important. And I think also that, like, it's funny because most of the leftists think that he lost that exchange. And I'm like, they both, when I read that, I'm like, they both came off looking stupid. But he actually came off looking slightly less stupid.
Right.
Because while he was doing so, I think some of his tactics were not advisable. Mm-hmm. He seemed to actually – he would actually engage in an argument instead of like, I told you to read my 50 books.
Let's set this up a little bit more. The reason why I want to talk about Sam Harris is this. I have found that the people who still call themselves in some way or another leftists, maybe they're Sanders supporters, people who are wanting to, on the one hand, oppose identity politics, but on the other hand, continue to work on changing the world for the better or progress or, you know, have not just swung to the right. Like Sam Harris, the new atheists are the liberal left side of the Enlightenment. They're not anti-Enlightenment thinkers, you know. They're holding on to reason. There's one guy named Dusty who has a YouTube channel, and he, like, wears a hat that says logic. You know, and on the one hand, it's so stupid and so, you know, so bro-y. But on the other hand, I kind of like that. You know, if you actually stuck by that, you'd be okay, maybe. So I think Sam Harris is important to see why he has sort of failed, what's wrong with him, and then also why the left can't beat him fairly, maybe.
These are some good questions. You know, because you and I know that I hate Sam Harris. Like, personally, of the new atheists, my two least favorite are and have always been Richard Dawkins and has Sam Harris. I'm a fan of Jerry Coyne. I'm not so much a fan of PC Myers, but I'm a fan of Daniel Dennett, although I never realized why he was in that list in the first place. I was a fan of Mr. Stinger. And what's funny, the most of the people I'm a fan of are not the famous ones. That said, all of them have had a rightward swing in the last years, except for PC Myers, and those around the Atheism Plus movement, which is just liberalism without God. A couple of the original New Atheist gangs are now even linked to the alt-right, which is weird. Harris is interesting because Harris is so obviously a neoconservative, but he does not see himself that way.
He's a neoconservative. I think he resists that. He ends up saying things that sound like neoconservatism from time to time. I think he'd like to be a liberal.
Well, I mean, he keeps on saying he's a liberal, but he liked Theodore Dalrymple until Dalrymple went after him. He liked who's kind of an arch conservative. He likes the liberal what's his face, the opponent of Norman Finkelstein so much, Bernard. What's his name? The lawyer.
Alan Dershowitz?
Yes, Alan Dershowitz,
yeah.
Who, you know, considers himself a liberal, even though he's the one that came up with the entire terrorist argument used by the Bush administration. So they don't consider themselves to be neoconservatives. But you get frustrated with Harris sometimes because, for example, he says that he didn't say in his first book that you should bomb people for what they believed, except he totally did, and I could point out the page number. That said, his views have evolved. I mean, like, he calls for an Islamic reformation more than bombing them and stuff like that. Not to defend him too hard. But what's interesting is I've listened to several debates, not just a Chomsky one. There's a couple of ones where, as much as I hate Sam Harris, I had to go, well, Sam Harris is actually – he's not being entirely intellectually honest himself. But he's being more intellectually honest than the person he's arguing with.
I'd go further and say I think Sam Harris is intellectually honest most of the time, as best he can be, and that he doesn't see the problems in his own argument.
Well, he assumes good motives a lot, like a whole lot of one group and not of another.
Well, yeah, let's go into it. The whole thing is focused on Chomsky's statements right around the time of September 11th, saying that we should compare the attacks of September 11th to Clinton's bombings in where did he bomb again? I should know.
The Sudan.
Yeah, the bombing.
The Sudanese hospital.
Sudanese pharmaceutical company.
Yeah, it was a Sudanese pharmaceutical company. That's right.
Yeah, it was a manufacturing plant that they thought might have. It might be used for weapons, or that's what they claimed, but it was really wiping out the regions, the Sudan's, like 50% of the medicine that was being produced in the Sudan was being produced there. So it had a tremendously devastating effect on the Sudan. Chomsky says this, and at the time, it seems outrageous for a couple reasons. One is, just on the surface, on the level of appearance, very few, if anyone, died when Clinton bombed the plant, as opposed to the 3,000 people who died, like, instantly in the World Trade Center. This is goes without saying about the World Trade Center. But so people thought that it was kind of a bizarre thing for him to claim. And it got a lot of scrutiny from a lot of quarters. And so he had to defend his claim many times. And I think what he did and what he does is he came up with a boilerplate response to all the criticisms and gave it universally. I mean, it didn't change it. Which speaks to the fact that Chomsky doesn't debate. He said something, he got a lot of criticism, he said something to the criticism, and now he's done. He's not going to work on that anymore. He's figured it out, and that's the end. The question is, how do we judge these events, and on what calculus are we judging them? I mean, what are the ethical implications of an event like this attacks of September 11th, as opposed to the bombing of the pharmaceutical plant in the Sudan? And Chomsky, on the one hand, makes an argument about what the ethical implications are, and on the other hand, doesn't want to actually overtly or concretely make any ethical claims.
I would not disagree with that. He does not really want to double down on, like, the substantive. Whether or not his equivalence was actually substantive seems to be part of what is a question. Like, and he doesn't really want to say that they're substantially the same. Like, he doesn't want to say, for example, that the collateral damage is morally the same as direct damage.
But in this debate, he actually says it's worse. It's morally
right.
More offensive and worse.
Which is probably the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Right.
I don't even know how to respond to that. Like, so accidentally killing people is morally worse, because if you take that to the logical extreme, you are saying that accidentally killing people is morally worse than intentionally killing them, which obviously is not what he's saying.
Well, but I think I think that his argument is this: it's not as though people didn't know that the pharmaceutical plant was producing medicine for the Sudan, and that there would be collateral damage, on the scale of tens of thousands. And look, you don't even have to go there. I mean, a parallel example in our policy would be the sanctions in Iraq.
Right, which killed tons and tons of people.
Right.
I mean, tons of
people. Madeleine Albright said something like, it was worth it. It was worth it to secure the region.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
So she did an ethical calculus and decided that at 100,000 children that died because of the sanctions, or some number. That was an unintended consequence of the sanctions, but one that was known. That was known in advance that would happen, but it was like a calculated in. It's like when an automobile manufacturer knows that there's a faulty wire and that part of the cars are going to blow up. And releases the automobile anyway because it's calculated that expense, won't be so detrimental to make it unprofitable and blah, blah, blah.
I was a recall coordinator. My job was to apply the formula.
Here's the infant went through the windshield. 3 points.
A new car built by my company leaves somewhere traveling at 60 miles per hour. The rear differential locks up.
The teenager's braces are wrapped around the backseat ashtray. Might make a good anti-smoking ad.
The car crashes and burns with everyone trapped inside. Now, should we initiate a recall?
The father must have been huge. You see where the fats burn to the seat with the polyester shirt? Very modern art.
Take the number of vehicles in the field, A, multiply it by the probable rate of failure, B, then multiply the result by the average out-of-court settlement, C. A times B times C equals X. If X is less than the cost of a recall, we don't do one.
Are there a lot of these kinds of accidents?
You wouldn't believe.
Which car company do you work for?
A major one.
I don't know how you make that judgment.
Well,
like, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know how to adjudicate that that's worth.
Well, this is where philosophy starts to matter, because Sam Harris is working on a strictly hedonistic or utilitarian ethics.
Sam Harris works on a purely utilitarian hedonistic calculus. I suspect Chomsky is a Kantian, although he does not ever state that, but I suspect he is. Right. Although even then, a Kantian would argue that
the outcome isn't what's important.
The outcome isn't what's important, whereas he's arguing that, but the bad intentions would matter more than no intentions at all. And he's arguing that no intentions is actually more offensive because it's more thoughtless. I don't know.
It's more dehumanizing.
So he has this idea of human agency that's different from Sam Harris's. And honestly, at that point, I don't know how they adjudicate between the two. I find both of their moral stances actually somewhat maddening. But I will give Sam Harris this. He does actually state his moral preference.
Right.
He states it as an objective truth, which I think is a debatable thing, but he does actually state his moral preference. Even though Chomsky talks about morality constantly, I actually don't know that I know what his moral framework actually really is, and I've read a bunch of his books.
Well, I don't think – see, here's the thing. I don't think the left has a moral framework. I don't think Chomsky does.
You think it has a moralism but not a moral framework?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even think that that is shocking or horrible because I've taken ethics classes and I've never come out of them with any moral framework or ethical framework that works.
No, they usually fall apart pretty quickly.
So it's not a surprise that, I mean, like what someone like Harris, and I think this is a sort of a conservative move maybe, what someone like Harris does is says the best one is this. Best one is, you know, utilitarian calculus. That's obviously the best one. So I'm going to go with that.
Right.
And the fact that it falls apart, well, so do all the others. This is still the best one. Sort of using its own, you know, using utilitarian ethics to justify taking, using your own ethics to justify choosing that frame is sort of what's happening there.
Right. It's circular. It's. Which, in his book about ethics, which is one of the reasons I hate him, that is the circularity of the argument's actually explicit. But that's not what we're talking about today.
Right.
What's more maddening with Chomsky is, like, he talks about morality all the damn time. Really does. All the time. Yet, what do we make of this? Because, like, I don't know that I really understand where his... Like, why is it more dehumanizing? Because you treated humans as something in a calculation? But, like, most things do that.
Well, Kant says that you shouldn't, right? I mean, that's the golden rule.
Right.
To not treat people as tools or as objects, but as other subjects, you know, in the
but
world.
But if you try to make Chomsky own up to the fact that he's really a Kantian, I don't think he'd do it.
Yeah, well, there's a problem, you know. Why not? This is what's frustrating with people like Chomsky or with the left in general is that we are shy of scrutiny in a way that even the worst of, say, the new atheists, which you say Sam Harris is not.
Right.
This is what I don't quite understand with Chomsky. Where is it, or at what point did he decide that... that it's better not to put your real opinions into the mix. What is that called when you do that? There's a technique in debate where people, it's like bait and switch, but it's not that. It's Moton Bailey.
Moton Bailey. The Moton Bailey doctrine.
Yeah.
Which is a guy at Slate Star Codex is actually always talking about and saying it's like the default left-wing tactic. And frankly, I hate to agree with him, but he's not wrong. It is the default left-wing tactic.
Well, no. Who is this guy that says this? Is he a right-winger? That's
Gal Alexander. No, he's a liberal. He's a right. He's a kind of a right-wing liberal.
Yeah.
He's not like – he probably votes for Hillary Clinton, but he – I would consider him a right-winger, yes.
Okay.
But he's definitely a liberal, and he's always fighting identity politics people, which I'm sure eats up a lot of everybody's energy these days, but either defining it or defending it depending on your inclination.
Can you ignore it? Is it possible to just ignore it?
I try to. I really do. You notice I don't go off on social justice warriors ever on my blogs or anything, because I just I used to, and then this went. I had this moment of like realization where I was like, I'm getting sucked into this game. It's just going to make me look stupid, even if I win. So I'm just going to back away and let the rest of you people deal with this. Mm-hmm. And this is my stance on the whole thing. And I know that sounds weird. And
it sounds smart. I'm suspicious that it may not be. It's smart. I mean, why am I? I tried to take that position for a long time, and now I find it very, very difficult not to say things. And
you know why? You work in publishing, and I work for you, but you actually work in publishing as a writer, whereas I work as a poet. And who gives a shit what I think? So I don't have – there's not always litmus tests popping up that make me take a side on this. I mean, even as a teacher, it just doesn't come up in my daily life the way it does if you're a professor. That was when I cared more, guess what my job was?
Oh, yeah, you were a university lecturer.
I was a university lecturer. I gave a big shit then. Now I'm like, who cares? these people are just going to rant at each other in universities that I no longer work at. Talk about a social materialism, but I really do think that's part of it.
Right, yeah.
Because I will say, everybody who I know that has gotten into these fights where it's really affected them and also where they really care, they all work in either I'm going to go even further and not even say nonfiction publishing. They all work either in academia or in genre fiction.
Huh.
And I'm not just talking about you. Like, that's where these battles really seem to matter. Whereas, like, for me, it's not that I don't have to deal with social justice ideas in the school, but I don't have to deal with the really dumb ones. Also, I live in a very conservative country, so they're just not going to come up in the same way. I mean, like...
Right.
I don't really know how to explain it, but they're just not. I mean, it would be like if someone asked me to take a stand. Like, I actually don't have a strong stance on the pronoun issue. I tend to call people by whatever they ask me to. Just tell me what you want. But I would never have to make that choice here, because that's not a choice that can be made here. So there's all kinds of stuff that I don't have to deal with, that thus I don't really care about.
I can't tell you how many people I heard from who think that he showed how ludicrous and unethical my concern about intentions was, for instance. He's dealing in the real world, but all my talk about intentions was just a bizarre and useless bit of philosophizing. But think about that for a second. Okay, our legal system depends upon weighing intentions in precisely the way I describe. How else do we differentiate between premeditated murder and crimes of passion and manslaughter and criminal negligence and just terrible accidents for which no one is to blame? Imagine your neighbor's house burns down and yours with it. Okay, what the hell happened? Okay, well, what happened has a lot to do with your neighbor's intentions. Okay, if he had a cooking fire that got out of control, that's one thing. If he tried to burn down his own house to collect the insurance payment, that's another. If he tried to burn down the whole neighborhood because he just hates everyone, that's another. Okay, intentions matter because they contain all the information about what your neighbor is likely to do next. Okay, there's a spectrum of culpability here, and intention is its very substance. Chomsky seems to think that he has made a great moral discovery in this area, and that not intending a harm can sometimes be morally worse than intending one. Now, I'm pretty sure that I disagree, but I would have loved to discuss it. I wasn't debating him about anything. I was trying to figure out what the man actually believes. It's still not clear to me, because he appeared to be contradicting himself in our exchange. But in response to my questions and the thought experiments I was marshaling trying to get to first principles, all I got back were insults. But worse, many people seem to think that these insults were a sign of the man's moral seriousness. I mean, many seem to think that belligerence and an unwillingness to have a civil dialogue is a virtue in any encounter like this. And that simply vilifying one's opponent as a moral monster by merely declaring him to be one is a clever thing to do.
The problem with Sam Harris, now, I don't know what would happen if he met someone from the left who tried to be honest and argue with him directly about, say, faults in utilitarian logic or utilitarian ethics, I mean. But I don't think he gets a lot of honest argumentation from people who are to the left of him.
What do you make of all this now? I mean, like, who do you think benefited or didn't benefit from that, the way that debate went?
I think Chomsky benefited from that debate more than Harris did. Harris, I think, hurt his reputation in that debate. And Chomsky didn't lose anything. And that's why Chomsky debated the way he did. Because to debate honestly would have put his politics at risk. Not himself. He's 83. His reputation only matters to the extent that that he represents something larger than himself, I think, to him. That's my assumption of how he operates. So I think I think Chomsky won that debate in the terms of the political culture. I think if you look at it objectively, there was no debate. I think that Sam Harris's depiction of it as a failure to even have an argument is correct.
That was what I got from it, is it kind of went nowhere in terms of anything. Like, they couldn't even get to a point where they were laying out their definitions in a way. And that, since Chomsky refused to do that, refused to lay out his definitions.
Right.
That there could no debate could ever take place, but Chomsky's reasons for saying that is that it was useless. I think the real reason is this: Chomsky was not going to lay out his real assumptions, because his real assumptions would expose fractures in the left on just a whole lot of stuff.
Maybe the problem is that we just don't have any mutual trust or any trust in argumentation. I'm like, if you can't have an honest debate with someone like Sam Harris,
you can't have an honest debate, period.
Because Sam Harris, as bad as he is on some idea on torture, I think he's wrong. Look, I think he's totally wrong when it comes to how to deal with ideologies that you oppose.
Right.
Frankly, he's frighteningly wrong. This is why there were re-education camps, you know? Like, you listen to what he wants to do to the Islamic people. He wants to get them to change their thoughts before they get into the country. But he's not saying these things in a way that's intellectually dishonest. He just has a perspective on the relationship between the ideas people hold and their actions, which isn't complicated enough, you know, which doesn't take into account material forces. Like, he hasn't read Marx's critique of Feuerbach, and which is an important critique. I mean, it turns out not just to be a joke, because it matters whether or not you think of ideologies as needing material support or not. So anyway, but the main point that I would make is that we on the left are doing ourselves no great service by avoiding being intellectually honest in responses to people like Sam Harris. We need to have more confidence in our ideas and risk losing some cherished beliefs. I mean, I guess I'm just, I might as well be going, say amen at this point, because it's such boilerplate rationalism that I'm spouting, but.
I don't have that faith and reason that you do, because I am tied up in logics all the time and realize what it doesn't get you. But that said, it's maddening the fact that we can't get people to lay down all their propositions, because in someone who's not someone like Chomsky, these sort of ad hoc frameworks get multiplied out together. So, like, someone will read a Chomsky book, and then they'll read some Maoist book and not realize it's a Maoist book. They just, you know, blah, 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 imperialism.
Yeah.
And they'll read this other thing. And they'll have all these ideas, and they'll throw them at you in this hazard wash of, like, trying to argue with you about it, but they don't know any of the frameworks from which those ideas sprang, and they don't know that they're throwing shit at you that isn't even coherent enough for you to make sense out of if you actually, like, decoupled all the background information. But since no one's stating their background assumptions, and part of this Mate and Bully thing is actually bad faith.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm actually not accusing it on the case of Chomsky, but some of it's like, we don't want people to know that we're Maoist or whatever. Pick ideology here, not just Maoism. But so we have to go about all this obscuration so people don't figure out what we actually believe. But over time, this sort of like entryist stuff just becomes intellectual ad hocness because people are no longer in these organizations or whatever. And
they lose sight of the framework.
Who are hiding the framework are losing sight of the framework.
Yeah.
And to go a little bit even further than that, these people drink their own Kool-Aid, forgetting that it was Kool-Aid they were setting out in the first place. Conservatives do it too, but I mean, and that's one thing rationalism doesn't allow easily. Not that it doesn't ever happen, but it's a lot harder.
Well, say what you mean there. I mean, why doesn't rationalism allow for that to happen? I mean, it seems like obviously rationalist ideas accept that you can be irrational and that you can that these problems come up and when you try to argue rationally.
Because if you accept this formal debate structure, one of the first things you have to do is define your preposition. And if you actually define your prepositions and don't hide behind jargon as magic, a lot of times the fact that those prepositions come from incoherent frameworks become apparent to you before you even go and try to defend them. Because you do not subject yourself to this, it becomes a big problem. I'll tell you a problem I had on the left. I mean, this was with a leftist who like screamed at me. And what they were screaming at me about is when I said an assertion is not the same thing as an argument.
Right.
And they started screaming.
Were they typing in all caps or was it in person?
It's in person, and I've had it happen in all caps. It's happened to me twice. Yeah. They're like, assertion is an argument. No, it's not. An argument's not just a statement of belief. An argument is a statement of belief with corresponding support. That is the definition of an argument. Nuh-uh. I'm like, no wonder things like standpoint epistemology and stuff make this seem better because people assume that the statement is its own proof because of who says it, not what it says.
Right.
And also, once you've done that and you're overlaying all these other things with Kool-Aid, you can believe any crazy bullshit. For example, a favorite of mine is to talk about cultural appropriation. I don't actually think it's that dangerous that people believe in cultural appropriation because it doesn't matter. Most people just laugh it off. But one of the things it does illustrate to me is people who supposedly believe in socialism also somehow believe ideas can be owned by another idea group as like property. That's real damn weird if you think about it from people who supposedly are socialists.
Yeah, I know. I know.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, they look
it's
right.
Not defensible.
What you could say is, look, in this capitalist culture, I have to protect my ethnicity's cultural property, or else I will be oppressed. But in a socialist future, cultural appropriation will no longer be a problem.
But I'm not sure that you can even really argue that totally because, cultural groups do not, as cultures, benefit from cultural properties
right,
under capitalism.
Yeah, right.
Only indigenous do. So I don't understand.
Like, fair enough.
I'm just saying, like the entire setup just doesn't seem to correspond. It's got contradictory notions of agency and culture and stuff all written in it. That's not neither here nor there, but it's the fact that that's not clear to people seems to be come from the fact that people don't know how to argue anymore.
Right.
I don't think Sam Harris would be that hard to defeat in an open argument, but I don't think you would defeat him the way Chomsky did. And honestly, I don't even think Chomsky's statement is all that coherent. I'm not quite sure if the moral defense came before or after the statement. So.
What do you mean about?
The humanization argument. Like, because by that argument, sanctions are worse than bombing people.
Right. Well, all depends on outcomes, sort of. Or.
Yeah, but sort of, but not really. Like. It's like it all depends on outcomes, except when it doesn't, because the outcomes are different. I mean, it's just not a coherent argument.
Yeah. Right. I think that's why he doesn't stay with it. That's why he wants to say, what he ends up saying is something like, you can't think about intentions at all. Let's just not talk about intentions. Not that certain intentions are worse than others, but what he does say, but then he switches over to intentions don't matter, basically.
Which, by the way, would actually be the utilitarian assumption normally.
Right, and Sam Harris goes against that because what he says is, intentions give us a picture of future consequences.
Right, which...
I think is weak. I don't think they do, necessarily.
No, intentions give us a picture of imagined consequences.
Right.
Which aren't necessarily predictive. But, I mean, like... But again, like that's you're right. That argument isn't that hard to defeat.
Right.
But Chomsky's not defeating it.
Why not? Why doesn't he have enough respect for Sam Harris to take his argument seriously?
To actually debunk what he's saying, right? I mean, instead of to go, consequences matter. Oh, wait, that's hard. Never mind. Consequences don't matter. I mean, reverse that.
Intentions don't matter.
Intentions don't matter. Only consequences do. But I said intentions mattered, but then that became hard, so now intentions don't matter.
The thing is, he actually is giving him boilerplate. I mean, I've seen him say very similar things to other people before. He could even be copying and pasting to some degree in this exchange.
He also did refer to, like, read my book. It was kind of maddening. I mean, and, I gotta give. I mean, I think Harris. Some of the Harris's assumptions about intentions do become a problem, but again, that's not the actual intentions being a problem is not the same as intentions having no relevance.
So okay, so we can back up out of this and say okay, so we neither one of us agree with Sam Harris on many many different things, or at least on. For me, I don't agree with his utilitarian ethics, although I'm going to say, and I'm going to admit, I don't actually have a coherent framework for ethics. All I've got is a hope that I can maybe work that out someday.
I'm a virtue ethicist.
Okay.
I'm just going to put that out there.
Okay. I'd like to, well, you have to, maybe we could do a podcast on that and you can convert me. At the moment, I'm sort of Socratic about it. I'd love to meet someone who knew the right framework for ethical.
Well, the thing about a virtue ethics framework is it's not one framework. It's kind of a cop out. It's the we have objective traits we want in people. We know how to make the objective traits happen. Those objective traits are goods. You can't have all of them. Pick a few. Have a nice day.
Okay.
I mean, that's like it's actually much more complicated than that, obviously, but that's the very basic.
Right.
And that those traits need to come out of a coherent worldview. But that's the catch. However, like it's an out of the whole deontological utilitarian never ending bullshit debate. I find both those philosophical systems maddening.
Aristotle's philosophy is grounded in virtue theory, a theory of human excellence. Virtue theory in contemporary political philosophy is often contrasted with utilitarianism, a political philosophy whose moral reasoning is based on the logic that any action should be judged according to its results, that whatever results in the greatest good for the greatest number is the morally correct action. Or a third political mode of reasoning, deontological reasoning, a view which says that the individual is absolute and supreme and cannot have its value compromised. A view that says humans must always be treated as ends rather than means, and that the morally right action cannot be compared in any sort of consequentialist way of reasoning. So take a type of political scenario that we can imagine that would invoke different responses from these three different kinds of political philosophy. Take a scenario in which there is an individual terrorist with a bomb in a crowded city, and unless this terrorist demands a certain individual who's completely innocent is sacrificed by the government, then he will set off the bomb and kill 100 people. So the terrorist is creating a political calculus in which either one individual life will be sacrificed with no deserving reason, or 100 people will be killed. Now, the consequentialist, the utilitarian, says that it's an easy calculation. 100 is greater than 1, and so the calculus, the just thing to do, is simply to sacrifice the individual. The deontological, or we could even say the rights-based reasoning, says that the individual is sacrosanct, that there's no way to treat individual as a means to some greater ends, that it's fundamentally wrong to harm this individual who doesn't deserve it, and therefore, even if a greater number of people will die, then this individual must not be sacrificed. Aristotle would say this is a very difficult calculus, and he would say to the deontologist, what if it were 10,000 people? What if it were 100,000 people? Even then, would you not sacrifice this one individual? Aristotle's virtue theory would say that moral reasoning isn't about decision rules, that it's not about a kind of calculus that allows us to make these kinds of decisions, and that it's not about rights-based rules that determine what kinds of decisions can or can't be made. Aristotle would rather locate the morality of this situation in the person who's making the decision. He would say that these kinds of decisions call for virtue. In fact, that they call for phronesis. They call for practical wisdom. And so Aristotle says there isn't any rule-based answer to this kind of political quandary. What you must have in this situation is a political agent who has the practical wisdom in the context, in the circumstances, and all of their complexity to make the right decision. Which of these three is most satisfying to you? Is Aristotle's way simply a cop-out, a way of avoiding outlining what kind of decision would be made in this difficult circumstance? Or is it the most realistic and the most satisfying way to resolve these seemingly impossible moral problems?
If you take utilitarianism in its negative sense to its logical conclusion, no one should ever have babies. I'm actually serious about that. Like, antinatalism is the logical conclusion because it is easier to prevent pain than to ensure happiness. Pain is always a negative in the utilitarian calculus. Therefore, preventing life prevents pain. Therefore, no life. The end. it's a very simple argument. And based off of utilitarian presumptions, which show you how absurd it is.
Right.
Although some people believe it.
Right.
There are a few utilitarian philosophers who have taken this and actually run with it as a belief, but I think it actually began as an easy way to debunk utilitarian assumptions. Whereas it's really damn easy to debunk a deontological assumption. Nazis come to your door. Do you tell them you're hiding a Jew? I mean, that's the obvious one, but
right.
So there you go. Not that Kant didn't have an answer to it, but his answer becomes really unsatisfactory very fast since it becomes impossible to be a moral agent. So yes, you're right that like nobody has a coherent ethical framework, but everybody's always trying to sell you that they do. My favorites, there's this Alonzo Fife guy who is the atheist ethicist who has some kind, who really believes he has an objective moral system that has no need for meta-ethics. Sam Harris claims this too about his version of utilitarianism, which, again, I think is stupid, but at least he states his premises.